And tonight we have many, many beautiful new faces and students from two different places, I think. And so will one of the students from each group speak up and tell me where you're from and what you're studying and what you'd like to learn or to hear?
We're here from Charlie Huffman's class at Hunter College.
Uh-huh.
And we're in the Myth and Ritual class.
A Myth and Ritual.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And we've just begun studying these things.
You've begun studying what?
Islam and Sufism.
Okay. Interesting.
I, for one, have never, I don't know much about it. So.
Right. Okay. Good. That's interesting. I'm wondering where we fit into myth and ritual.
Well, they've been, I will say they've been studying how our creation stories give us meaning and how our rituals take us back to our time of origins.
Oh, interesting.
And we reenact.
Interesting.
We reenact as it was in the beginning, those moments of timelessness.
Right. Beautiful. 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 Yes. Well, tonight what you will experience is also a cosmic journey, it said, that the zikr is a representation of the entire soul's journey into form and into human body and then into the world of creation and as a praise of the source of creation. And then that return back into the source. So, and you might actually experience that. So it's not just symbolic, because that's the thing. When one hears ritual, it sounds like, you know, either something that has become like a conventional form, I mean, to me, to my ears, or something symbolic that of, you know, something else. But I think that the real ritual devotions or actions, it's often tied to devotion, actually. And that's, I think, when it has real significance. Is then a direct experience of a deeper nature. So, and Sufism is about direct experience. So, and yes, there are sacred forms, very important, significant sacred forms that we engage in. And as I said, the zikr is one, and then we have another, which is called salat, which are prayers of prostration. But they all take their meaning, really, from the reason, or the one we're bowing to, or the one we're moving in a circle for, or that's really where they take their significance from. So, and it's to bring us closer, to unveil us, and to both charge us to, you know, it's like a purification, so there's like a, almost like a cleansing effect, a washing, a way of, you know, like we call it the dust from the mirror. That's one image that's been used. And then a infusing of that mirror with light, with the divine light, the source of light. And so the ritual, as you call it, is really a bridge, is sort of a means, yes, to go closer. But we are always close. So, but it's very interesting how once we come into creation, we need, you know, created forms. So we need the form, of course. We are forms ourselves. We are, it's said that the, you know, God, who is formless, the source of all, who is formless but manifests through form. And so, you know, the human being is one of these forms. It's, in fact, the human being is called the crown of creation. So everything is contained in the human being. And everything that we see is really, in a sense, a projection of what is inside each of us. And, you know, so, yes, the rituals, the forms, the sacred forms of worship are made to reveal the human being, and to polish also, polish our hearts. Yeah. So, you know, and then we said we go beyond the form also. We don't just stay with the ritual. We say we, in a sense, we always aspire toward the essence and the source of all, which is, of course, within every form and beyond every form. So that's also our goal. It's not just to stay in the form. You know, there are many. So our goal is to be with the source. Our goal is to merge back into the beloved. You know, and again, these are metaphors for, because it said, the Sufi wisdom says we're never separate. The Quranic wisdom, really. But the Sufis have much more made use of that wisdom. You know, they're the ones, it's all in Quran. Actually, all of Sufism is in the Quran. But you wouldn't know it unless you sit, you know, within a Sufi gathering, or you read Sufi mystics and and hear how they understand things and interpret life. So good. So one has to have a longing, you know. That's, and the thing that's sparked is that longing for God within, or for God. I mean, first we might think God is outside, you know, so we long for God and we look up at the heavens. Even it's the prophet himself, actually, at first would pray. He'd pray toward Jerusalem, and it said he was kind of looking, gazing toward the heavens, because that's where the throne is. It's, you know, in that sense, over the earth above. So there is that sense of exaltedness, that God the exalted is there, but really God is here. And so the Sufi rituals really point to that very directly, of the being who is closer to us than our own life vein. And yeah. You know, one of the rituals, you might say, is the chanting. Part of the Sufi path is the chanting of the names, like mantras, you know, chanting God's names. And so it's interesting, would we classify that as a ritual? It doesn't have much outer appearance, but it's more all on the inner. But that's, you know, it's interesting to see what is ritual. It means a form. Then, you know, if we explore, it's a sacred form, and it's a window, therefore it's a transparency to the source, and it has a dynamic to it, so that if one engages in it, it will draw one into nearness and illumine one. You know, it has to have all those elements to be really alive and true. So Sufis chant, you know, we will do it communally here, but also every day on our own, we offer zikr. It's called zikr, remembrance of God, or evocation of God. And so that is, you know, I don't know if that would be called ritual, really. It's like a form of prayer. It's closer to what we would call prayer in our Western language, or meditation prayer. A meditative prayer, because we're actually meditating as we announce it, pronounce it, the name. You know, it's being meditated on. And then we even go to say, we are the ones meditated on, that God is meditating on us. You know, so, yeah. So, are there any other questions? Or? Yeah, and is you're all from that one class? No, I thought there were two classes coming tonight.
We have some guests here.
Oh, these are guests. Oh, hi. Welcome. Yeah, I thought you were students. We're all students, of course. Everyone, we never stop being students if we're alive, you know. Right. Oh, good. And so what are the guests seeking?
Well, Brian invited us.
Oh, good.
He's a good friend, and so I always see community with other people of faith.
You what?
I always see community with other people of faith, even if it's different from my own. So.
What is your own?
I'm Catholic.
You're Catholic.
Yes.
Oh, good. Well, Catholic. That's good. Yeah. Sheikh Noor, our teacher, was made a journey through all the sacred traditions. And at a certain point, he studied with the Orthodox very deeply and seriously, and with Russian Orthodox, St. Vladimir's up outside the city. But he had always felt, you know, that the Catholic was, I don't know what his notion, maybe he took an Orthodox view of the Catholics or something. But interestingly enough, at the very end of his life, I mean, toward that last summer of his life, he would drive the one who was taking care of his grandchildren. This was way out in, I think, Wisconsin. And he would drive her to church because she was Catholic. And he ended up meeting the priest. And the priest turned out to be a wonderful person, young, and introduced him to the new catechism that had come out of, you know, I guess since Vatican III or IV, or which was the with it. And so he was actually so impressed with it and said that it's, you know, how wonderful it is. And he ended up, I think the priest, I wanted to say he was buried. Yeah, he was buried in the Catholic tradition. That's so interesting. The priest, he asked the priest. He passed away here in Riverdale. But is that right? His body was brought, yeah, to Wisconsin. Way north, Sanor. And so the priest was the one who put him in the earth and with the Catholic prayers. So it was a very, very sweet journey. Kept it for the end. Yeah. Well, the Catholics have a good number of rituals, I know, because I also grew up in that tradition. It's beautiful. Yeah, and they're undergoing quite some. And now, what a wonderful Pope. I feel we have, I always say we, because any of these world leaders are for everybody, like His Holiness and Pope Francis is a remarkable, and we're so blessed, really, to have another, you know, universal voice supporting the human honor and human rights. And so good. Yeah. So what are some questions that the class would have? I mean, what would you ask your teacher, or what? No questions?
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Why women cover
our
heads
with scarves? Right. Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you know, my mind goes in different directions. One is historical, and then in that, you know, in the ancient world, women covered more, I think. But at the time of the Prophet, it was something that came as a revelation that they should cover to protect themselves. So it was a kind of protection and distinguishing them and keeping away. There was so much hostility at the time, so kind of keeping away a negative gaze, and because it is, as we know, clothing itself is a kind of protection, you know. Not just of temperature, but also of energies, so subtle energies that we can clothe. So that's, you know, one simple, you might say, thread in that. The other is that the head, you know, has often been covered in sacred traditions by both men and women. In fact, in many sacred traditions, the men cover their head, and as you see here, you'll see some white hats that are traditional. This was a man's hat, in the East. But here, we adopted it for women as well. So it's, you know, and that, again, but it's not just any hat. It has sacred writing on it, or sacred sort of what you would call geometry, or referring to divine names. So it's obviously a kind of window here, or a portal for drawing in, you know, powerful energies and then channeling them through the body and the heart. And so that is another reason that, and you know, you'll often find, I think if you look back into sacred or prophetic traditions, that, you know, there was a covering, as I said, both men and women, covering, because it also creates an inner space, an enclosure. And so often for prayer, in fact, they're often called, in different traditions, prayer shawls or things like that, because you retreat from the world with a cover. And, you know, and then something also of the, like somehow before God, there is, you know, if you have the experience of God as a majestic and as awesome, I think there is also that movement of response on the part of the servant to cover, you know. So these are all some of the reasons. But it can become a convention, as we know. And all of these things that have, you know, whose seed and whose origin is, you know, something to, you know, rather illumine us or protect us, or that then becomes a convention. And so as a convention, it becomes a barrier to the light. And so I don't espouse it myself, and I don't recommend it. Only if women choose to, you know, carry the veil throughout their day, that's fine. I mean, they're, you know, whatever seems right to their heart, and that seems to me the mature way, that as we go in the path, you know, certain things seem right for one. And then they're taken. They're there. That's, I often say that, you know, we have a banquet table full of knowledge and full of gifts. And, you know, everyone is seated around the table, and you avail yourself of what you need. So Sufism is something like that. It's totally non-coercive and comes from, because it comes from within. And so this whole life is a journey with yourself and God, or your, you know, or yourself, if you want to qualify the deeper self. So how can anyone else, in a sense, tell you what to do? But of course, education and making things available. I mean, you know, this gets into big discussions about, you know, contemporary Hazreti Mariam, who's living today, because it said every generation there is the person, there's the Hazreti Fatima, all the sacred people who, you know, whose souls are no longer in this world, but they have, who occupying their place in every generation. So I'm saying that the, who knows what the contemporary Hazreti Mariam is doing? She might not be veiled at all. In fact, I don't think she is. Because Effendi appointed her out once to me, and so. Yeah. Good, but that's a good question. So that would be exactly the case of a ritual that is, you know, but then, you know, what I wanted to say, a ritual that is not necessarily bringing benefit anymore. But on the other hand, you know, maybe women today do it, and Muslim women veil. Also in their society, there's much more divide between women and men. And so they feel, I mean, I've heard from that, very uncomfortable. You know, there's a much more kind of tension. Somehow in the West, a lot of that tension, I mean, not always, one can't just, you know, make two blanket statements, but is released, and there's much more evenness, even balance between men and women. So then it doesn't seem like necessary, you know. We could always, you know, maybe the equivalent in the West is like lowering our skirt line or something like that. You know, I don't know. I don't know. None of that is, but once in Sufism, it's all divine play. So, I mean, really, you know, and of course you try to educate and teach toward what brings happiness to people. That's really the goal, is human felicity. And, it's not some rigid rules of even of morality or anything. It's ultimately what brings happiness to the human being and to human society. And so, you know, of course, we need some codes of behavior and laws and, you know, forms that help that. But then, you know, how boring it would be if we didn't have all the rest. I mean, really, you know. That's what, you know, these utopias tried to do. They tried to organize everything so that it would be perfect and, you know, it becomes intolerable, you know. So we need the whole symphony and all the mistakes in it, so-called mistakes. Really, you know, that's the thing, is that the advanced Sufis are, they almost can't do anything because they feel, you know, this is all God's universe. This is not ours, you know, where we feel, well, we know best what to do. Not at all. And that's not how the prophets were. They were not people who said, well, we know and we're going to tell you. And no, they were really just the instruments of divine mercy that were moving in their time and spreading peace. So, yeah. Any more questions?
Mm-hmm. So how many different schools of Sufism there are?
Schools, yeah, lineages, a lot. Lineages. I think over, you know, in the hundreds. 42 main lineages of Sufism within 1,400 years or less, because these mostly the main ones branched off, you know, already hundreds of years ago. Our lineage comes from the 17th century. So that's not too long ago. It's about 300 plus years ago. And, you know, some people say that's the last branching of lineage there'll be, but who knows? You know. Yeah.
Is there a special characteristic to this lineage?
In each lineage, yes. Yeah, each one is like different flowers in the flower garden. You know, each one has its fragrance, it's and each one was, you know, sourced through a brilliant soul, and so it somehow carries their fingerprint, also their signature, but their signature is totally divine signature, you know, and the great lines were formed, through, was it 800, I mean, Geilani, or I don't know, maybe even earlier, but on through, through the 17th century, you could say. But he was also part of another major line that had formed much earlier in the, you know, 800 years before. So, they're each unique, and so it's wonderful. It's like you go to the market. You go to the Sufi market, you know, today. It's so extraordinary. Someone who goes to the Sufi market and feels, you know, drawn by this or by that, and something calls their heart. And so they end up in one of those lineages sooner or later. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or, I mean, that assumes that you, you know, aspiring in that direction. Which I always assume everybody is.
Why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't you? My mother was a Catholic Sufi, for instance. She stayed absolutely the Catholic. She was actually a convert. She was born in a big, you know, when those French Protestant family Huguenots, so they felt, you know, besieged by the Catholics for hundreds of years, and then she became a Catholic. She converted, and then she was like a very rigorous Catholic. I remember growing up, you know, and then she met Effendi. And she, various experiences in her life kind of opened her heart to Islam and to, really to Islam, you know, but not Islam through the Sufis. And then she met Muzaffar Effendi, who brought this lineage to the West, and she, you know, he melted her. He'd come and give her big bear hugs every time he'd come and see her, and he'd just hug her, and she was like, she couldn't resist. So, and she would do her tesbih. That was amazing for her. She would do her Sufi tesbih every day. So, I mean, she called herself a Sufi Christian, or a Christian Sufi. Mm-hmm. So it's possible to have initiation into a Sufi order and to retain, you know, one's tradition also. Yeah. Good.